Arena in Arlington, Virginia. But we really need many more of you to support this. If you believe in the necessity, the critical nature of democracy now, 202-588-9739, please make a pledge. Make a pledge now. We still need about $920. We can get there with your support. Coming up next is the wonderful E.F. Miller and On the Margin. But right now, you can go to the website at WPFWFM.org and make a pledge of support. You can call 202-588-9739. You're tuned to member-supported radio, WPFW Washington.
From New York, this.
Aline Goldbart is a writer, visual artist, and social activist. She has served as president of the board of the directors of the Shalom Center. Her new book is In the Camp of Angels of Freedom. How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's only 7 o'clock in New Mexico and I'm wide awake. So
I'm very happy. I saw you with your coffee, you know, so I'm glad you got a book. I think that what you've done, Arlene, it's a very beautiful book.
Thank you.
I was not familiar with your artwork, which graces the cover, as well as some of the individually angels who are in the book. But I want to begin by discussing the second part of your book first. You asked a question, what does it mean to be educated? You write, I want all to be granted the same freedom to pursue their chosen path to knowledge and to be respected for their skill and wisdom, whether or not they were acquired in an education institution. You also write, I support the freedom to choose one's own education. Why is this important?
Well, I think it's important to me for personal reasons, and then I'm making kind of a big claim that it should be important to everybody for political and moral reasons. You know, it's my story. I'm first generation in this country. Nobody went to college, including me. But I've made my way as kind of a public intellectual without portfolio. You know, you and I first met around cultural policy questions. That's an area that I've been very active in. It really wasn't an impediment for me to not have credentials, to not have a degree, because I was working a lot in countercultural spaces or in artistic spaces where, you know, people weren't checking your papers at the door. But it was also not an impediment to me because of the internalized prejudice of many
Recording
people
in
who
progress.
Have many people who have more privileged backgrounds. The default assumption is that if you're intelligent and articulate and capable, you must have acquired those qualities in an institution of higher learning. And so I was assumed to be somebody I wasn't. I'm not a young person anymore. And this has nagged at me for pretty much all my life because, you know, I took the odd moment. I mean, you've been in one of those meetings where somebody stands up and says, we're all so educated here and, you know, the path has been smooth for us. And what about the people who aren't in the room? And I, you know, for years I made a habit of like putting a pin in that and saying your prejudice is showing because you have assumptions about intelligence and class, about ability and class that you aren't acknowledging. You don't know the stories of the people who are in this room. So at this point in my life, having written, you know, a few different books about cultural politics and art, I thought, I want to tell this story. How am I going to tell it? I can give you the origin story later, but to answer your question, it was my feeling of urgency about that, my feeling of the importance of that was growing and growing and growing over time because just being out and about in ordinary life was exposing me to so many incidences of people expressing their disrespect and dismissal of those who they thought weren't their equals because they weren't credentialed in some way. You know, from the very banal of like being rude to somebody who's waiting on you in a coffee shop or you know, a bookstore to, you know, the political analysis that comes down now around the recent elections. There's this trope in it. There's the college educated and the non-college educated, and a huge analysis is being built on the idea that these are two radically different groups of people.
Well, let's look at something that has occurred in the last few years, and that is, do people need to go to college? And you might recall, even before that, it was a sense that, okay, let's focus on community colleges where people might just go back to school to get, a skill and then go back into the workforce. We also see in terms of the last several years that people who have technical skills, somebody who might have been playing computer games or whatever, all of a sudden now, when you call the IT person at this university, it's somebody who doesn't have a degree but who knows to use the equipment. How has that changed how you view education in terms of, you mentioned age, and has things changed?
Certainly, that tech thing has changed. I mean, Peter Thiel is the right-wing libertarian, former campaign financer of J.D. Vance. He gives people $100,000 if they will drop out of college and work on inventing something in that high-tech world. And all those guys, the Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, you can list them all. They might have started, but they finished in a garage somewhere, and then some zillionaire gave them venture capital. So yeah, that's definitely changed the idea. But the people who want to get into elite schools, Harvard, Yale, et cetera, that number increases every year. The scarcity of that admission increases every year. It's less than 3% of the people who apply now that are admitted, which is really bizarre when you think about the fact that population growth has meant, I think I have my numbers right, Ethelbert, 44% more people have graduated from high school than did population-wise 40 years ago, but only 14% more students are admitted to these elite schools, I believe, colleges and so forth. So they've chosen to promote scarcity, and the scarcity has become a super attractive thing, and people kill themselves
Well,
sometimes
let's go
over.
back. Let's go back to the founding of this country. Let's talk about the founding fathers because the mothers are not there. When we look at that group of individuals, we see at that particular time, early 1700s, education was for the few. Okay. And that sort of leads and carries into the creation of our documents, our constitution, or how we view the Declaration of Independence, all those things in terms of the many of the people who came here were, shall we say, at the bottom of the society in Europe. So how do we see education? And then I'm looking at what happened, especially after the Civil War, where African Americans are key in terms like public education and pushing to get to read and write, and you have people moving into education in numbers where were not there before.
Well, I mean, it's sort of two tracks running in the same direction, right? On the one hand, there's a class culling going on in society, and it's manifesting in all different sectors of society. For example, you and I met. You're an artist. I'm an artist. You and I met in that space. And if you go back to the 1800s, you can see that a typical program of art presentation would be like a potpourri. It would be like somebody would read a poem, someone would do a magic trick, someone would sing an aria. And in the 19th century, especially with the growth of the Boston Philharmonic, which was one of the first big established arts institutions like that, they started purifying it. So if you're going to sing an aria, you got to sing the whole opera, and you can't have magic tricks on the same program. And the people, Henry Higginson there in Boston, who was talking about that, he said, we must civilize these people to save our fortunes, basically. So
I'm
that's
thinking
going
about,
on.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking like I missed a carnival in
Yeah,
the
me too. I miss the fun, a lot of it,
I found your book fun reading because your book is not just about educational policy. Your book is also a memoir. So I found a lot about your life. There are, and we'll talk about some of your angels that appear in your life. But you also mentioned a very important essay by Havel, 1978 essay called The Power and the Powerless. Talk about what's in that essay.
Everybody should now go online and read it instantly if you haven't done it, because it's so important for our moment in society. Havel wrote this at, I think it was 78, didn't, isn't that what you just
1978,
said?
correct.
And so that was at a low point for him. I mean, after that, the Velvet Revolution succeeded. He became president of the new nation and so forth. But at that point, it was a moment of despair, not unlike, in some ways, the moment that we are experiencing in the United States now. And what he talked about was the fact that he called his society at that point a post-totalitarian one, meaning you didn't have to have someone stationed on every corner pointing a machine gun at you to get you in line. the obedience and the rituals of obeisance had been inculcated in people. So he talks about, you know, a greengrocer who is required by law to have a sign in the window of the shop saying "Workers of the World Unite," as if, you know, people coming in to buy an onion were going to be uplifted by this and, you know, change the way that they are in the world. Talks about these gestures that are demanded of people to go along with what this regime wants. And then he talks about music and other forms of performance, other forms of art, as things that people can do to express the power of the powerless, to remind themselves and each other that they are full human beings, that they're entitled to their place in the world, that they can't be erased, obliterated by a regime like this. And at the point where, when he was writing, there was a band called the Plastic People of the Universe, who was a favorite of Frank Zappa. And those people were put in jail for performing their music at a very loud, noisy, you know, rock music at a concert that was considered an act against the state. And so Havel was offering to us the choice between living within the lie, going along with what's demanded, you know, compliantly, quietly, with no counter energy, or living within the truth. And what he exhorted us to do is live within the truth. And that, I think, is our situation right now, too.
Well, look at our situation right now when you say that truth, where because of how information and misinformation is out there, we question what is the truth. People are operating on their individual silos. They go to one particular podcast or one particular news station. They read one particular newspaper. Who's to say this is the truth?
Well, of course, I mean, I'm going to be emperor of the world now and say what the truth is for everybody. But you and I know that there are multiple truths in every corner of human existence. But I'm not going to include that the election was stolen, and I'm not going to include that women don't have the right to autonomy over their own bodies, and, you know, the whole laundry list of...
Is there a difference between truth and fact?
That's a good question. I don't know. Would you say all facts are true?
That's a question. I'm doing the interview. I'm asking the questions. But I just, you know, we talk about it. I don't know if I think there might be a difference.
Yeah.
It sounds like something dealing with Orwell or something out of like Animal Farm or something like that.
It does. Yeah.
But it is a question that I think we need to ponder. The same way, for example, I was looking at the difference between democracy and republic.
Uh-huh.
In terms of how you protect minority rights,
everyone,
you have the number, but that doesn't mean, you know, you control everything.
Yeah. A lot of us have agreement on ultimate aims, but sadly, we have very little agreement on the journey that it will take to get there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. There's this guy who used to do a lot of really important oral history projects in Italy that I knew, and he used to say, "Not all stories are accurate, but all are true." And what he meant was that people would distort the facts consciously or unconsciously to match with their understanding of the world, but that there would be a kernel, an essence of truth contained in each story, even if the facts mm-hmm. that you and I were just talking about were wrong. So, you know, there's all this analysis of the election. There's a kernel of truth in it, which is that a lot of working class people believed Trump's lies more than they believed what was being told to them by the opposition. And that's something instructive that we can learn from. And it seems to be a fact. But
something that's very religious. Yeah. And I was looking at this. We sometimes look at something like, for example, if I see something, if I see people attacking the Capitol on January 6th, I see something. But then I'm going back to this biblical reference where Jesus is resurrected and everybody hears that Jesus is resurrected. But then there's Thomas who says, okay, I want to touch the wound. I mean, I hear all this thing about the resurrection. I see this guy over there, but I got to touch the wound to confirm the fact that he is risen. So I'm looking at that in terms, okay, we see things on TV, we hear things on the radio and podcasts, but does that really mean that I was actually there on January 6th?
Of course not. But how do we choose what to believe? I mean, one thing that I think is really important to do is always interrogate our own assumptions, you know, and that means being aware of what they are. We have a predisposition to believe the people that we like and to mistrust the ones who we think aren't really, you know, our kind of folks. And that sometimes blinds us to truth that would be useful because it comes from unexpected sources, even sources that we don't want to appreciate. So I think there's this process of self-questioning that always has to be part of arriving at whatever you or I might think is true for us. And I will say that we are living in a time, at least in the political sphere, with a marked lack of self-questioning and a tremendous amount of arrogance going down.
Let's talk about something which you write about in your book, In the Camp of Angels of Freedom. You put a heavy emphasis on self-education, okay? And I'm wondering how, during your lifetime, how self-education, when you were growing up and coming of age, is different from self-education now where I'm a young person, I have access to the internet.
Yeah, well, that's a really good question because there's a positive answer and a negative one, right? I mean, the positive answer is I say, go read Havel, and you have to do click, click, and he's there, right? So that's fantastic. I mean, that's miraculous and amazing. You and I had to trek to the library a lot of different times, and they wouldn't even let us take out all the books, right?
Or not have the book.
Right, so they'd definitely not have the book. So access, amazing, amazing, amazing. Sadly, there's just tremendous access to bullshit as there is to however you define truth. And because of that, credulousness is constantly being stimulated. People say, that sounds right to me. You know, I'm going to go with that. So-and-so said it, and you know, I like so-and-so. And that's really, really dangerous for us. I mean, I'm repeating myself because this process of interrogating your own assumptions is obviously the antidote to credulousness.
I'm looking at self-education in terms of looking at your life, because this book is also a memoir. Your self-growth and development in terms of, okay, how do I know that I need to be reading books about philosophy? Or how important is art in terms of my education?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I have to come back to one word, and that's curiosity. I honestly don't think I followed any recommended curriculum or, you know, told myself I need to be doing this. But I had a lot of fortunate experiences in which a book arrived or a painting, you know, an image of a painting arrived or whatever, just at the time I needed to see it and be taken down a path that it would lead me. I think curiosity has to be the best teacher. And, you know, you were talking about founding fathers, and I'm guessing this is true for the mothers too, that curiosity was in fact what led them. I mean, look at somebody like Jefferson, you know, who wrote so much about his daily life. That was it, right? He wanted to know how to build things, how a flower worked. He wanted to know some really bad stuff too. But this feeling of being permitted to follow your curiosity.
Well, let's look at you. You write about, you know, being, you know, in terms of your immigrant family, your family coming from Russia. How much is this curiosity really an important characteristic for the immigrant? You know, this curiosity, I'm curious about the new country that I am, or I'm curious about what happened in the old country that I left.
Yeah. Well, for the first thing you said about the new country, it's essential because it's almost always true that the children of immigrants have to learn to navigate the systems and customs of the country on behalf of the older people who may not have the language, may not have some of the skills, or may just be too busy, you know, working or whatever, to learn themselves. And so you learn to interpret systems, navigate systems. You learn to suss out what people want from you, which isn't always made explicit. And I mean, it's curiosity, but it's necessity too, right? Because if you don't do that, the bills don't get paid or people can't find their way.
Right. And talking about the bills getting paid, that's a good opportunity for us to talk about the fact that you're joining us here today at WPFW during our end of the year fundraising drive. And I'm encouraging all people to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And this is a good opportunity to bring in Miyuki and talk about the station.
Talk about the station, but also about the incredible job that E. Ethelbert Miller does. here on the show, On the Margin. He does an incredible job of bringing great information to us through poetry and writing. And it's really, really important things that he does, because poetry and writing allow people to articulate emotions and thoughts that are often difficult to express in ordinary conversation. And it provides an outlet for exploring joy, grief, love, and anger. And even our subject today, we're talking about the value of a human life, cost of human dignity. What is, what is the truth, and what are facts? Those conversations that make us think, that give us thought, that are provocative. If you appreciate this, if this is where your ballywick, where you listen to that, where you get your injection of cerebral and spiritual information, do take a moment, make a pledge of support to 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739. You can go to the web at wpfwfm.org, or you can go to Cash App. That's $WPFWFM. And the last one is, the newest one is, text WPFWFM to 801-801. He's got a goal of $600. He can reach that, because I know that people adore and appreciate and respect the work and know that it's a value, that is something you can rely upon here on the airways. 202-588-9739. Let's get back to this extremely engaging and informative conversation. Thank you, Ethelbert. Thank you, Ms. Colbert.
Thank you, Yuki. Since we're talking about that, and we're talking about money and stuff, this is a good way to talk about your angels in your book, because our station needs angels. But you talk about angels coming out of the Jewish tradition. Talk about what angels mean.
Well, in the Hebrew word for angels is malachim, so that means messengers too. So the idea is, especially in Jewish mysticism, that this physical world that we live in is one of four concentric worlds, each of finer and finer essence and higher spirit. And angels then become messengers between those worlds. So there's a lot of Bible stories that tell that, right? Jacob laid down on a rock and wrestled with an angel. I mean, there's many of them. A lot of people on the political left are allergic to things like angels. So I made sure to say in my book that if you just want to say teachers or people who inspired you, you can do that too. You've seen the painting, so you know I don't see them as little cherubs on a fluffy white cloud.
But you did give people wings.
I did give people wings, and I gave each of them, there's 11 teachers in the book, and each of them is depicted as an angel with wings. But wings, for instance, I gave Paulo Freire scarlet ibis wings, because that's the national bird of Brazil. So, the wings have something to say about who they are. And a quality, because in that understanding of angels, angels are in camps.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this angel. And I'm looking at your journey, your path, Arlene Goldbart. Do these angels... When did you realize they were angels? And did they appear at certain times where you were going through a crisis, you were going through like a divorce or something like that you write about in your book, that the angels appear at this particular time to move you to the next chapter, the next level of your life?
Oddly, yes. I mean, I'm not particularly sure that there's some supernatural strings being pulled there, but the essays in the book about the angels are in chronological order during a pretty long span, but of my life. And in each case, yes, there was something discovered that enabled me to move on my path. Mm. The how this came to be is, I was a visual artist always, but I stopped painting for a long time for political reasons. Basically, people were saying it's a bourgeois thing to do, and I was young and stupid. And
they told me about that with poetry. Somebody said, you're a bourgeois poet.
There you go. And they were wrong, but it took me a long time to catch up. But I started again not that long ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And COVID came down not too long after I started. I could no longer paint people from life. My subjects are always human beings. So what did I want to paint? And this image of James Baldwin as an angel came to me first, because I understood that his work had appeared in my life at these key points where I needed to be lifted up by someone who had suffered greatly but was still infused with a kind of love that I could only aspire to, that I could only imagine. And so when the COVID thing happened and I had to paint, I thought, I'm going to paint my angels. And I spent some time picking these 11 people, you know, I'm a little superstitious, Ethelbert, so they had to be dead, right? I couldn't pick people who inspired me that were still alive, because what if I had that power? So they were all people who had passed away. And, you know, I worked on my list for a while, and then I began to paint them all. And there are a few words inscribed on each painting that say who each person is the angel of and the quality that they hold. But then, you know, I'm a writer, and it wasn't enough words for me, and I realized I wanted to write an essay about each one.
Okay, well, let's look at what you have here. I'm glad that you said that Baldwin was the first angel that you did. But if I pick up your book, Nina Simone is on the cover. Okay. Talk about why Nina Simone is on the cover and not, say, James Baldwin. Is this a gender issue? Is this the fact that you were moved maybe by one of Nina Simone's songs as opposed to one of Baldwin's essays? But you made a decision to put a particular angel on the cover.
Why I Nina must Simone? Confess it's Nina Simone is who my publisher said would make the best cover. And I said, okay.
You see, now that could have been the devil talking to you. You don't know. but that's interesting, because you know what happens? And I had that answer in a book I was working on. Me and my friend Carlos, who did these beautiful drawings, we had this skull, you know, dealing with the Pinochet, you know, regime. And the cover wound up being a butterfly, you know, because the woman was concerned about the marketing. Somebody sees this skull on the cover, they're not going to pick up the book. And I can see, okay, Nina Simone. Okay, now what happens is if I'm passing the book, I think before I see your name Goldbard, that you're an African-American woman, because I see this Nina Simone on the cover, you know. So I was just looking at the decision, because the picture that I got attracted to was Abraham Herschel, that I felt that drawing was very strong. I would have put that one on the cover.
Abraham Joshua Heschel, absolutely, really, really, you know, the father of radical amazement, which we could spend the whole hour talking about. Yeah, I mean, I can ask Lynn why she picked it. I just figured she knows what she's doing, and I said yes.
Well, look what you also said in your book. You said this: Simone was the queen armored in elegance. In Simone, I saw what I've been stumbling towards, the first woman who seemed to hold a key to the life I long to live. So if I'm your publisher or editor, what you say in your book, I'm saying, well, let me pull that out and put that on the cover.
That could be. And in each essay, for each of those people, there is a moment, you know, where something coheres and where I learned something that wasn't clear to me before, and where that something carries me into a different set of possibilities in my life. So that's the one for Simone. But as you know, there's one for each chapter.
Well, let's go back to Nina Simone, because we're a radio station. Music and jazz is very important.
Yeah.
What songs of Nina Simone are the ones that resonate with you?
Well, I put a little bit about that in the book, and I think I'm going to take a second and answer you, because, you know, when I encountered Nina Simone, I was in high school. I was in high school in a suburb of San Francisco. And when I wrote in the book, is that her first recording was released in 59. I was at the time I discovered her in high school, I think it was 62. I wrote this: I remember Willow Weep for Me, Wild is the Wind, Trouble in Mind, Pirate Jenny, and in our last year of school, Simone's own composition, the searing civil rights song, Mississippi Goddamn. But I would have to say that all three of those, you know, Willow Weep for Me, Wild as the Wind, Trouble in Mind, they all had that quality of something that pre-existed, that she made her own, that she expanded the meaning of the song by the way that she performed it, both on the piano.
Let's get back to you. Are these songs occurring at this, you took by high school, is this helping you get through that, what they would call rites of passage?
Well, what I would say is the fact that she existed helped me, because I discovered her because I had a friend who was just as alienated as me, but from a very different background. Her family had been in the Central Valley of California and kind of risen up out of agricultural stuff to Her dad sold insurance, but they liked jazz. And I'd never heard any until I went to her house. And it was always the FM station, and there were always these records, including Nina Simone to play. And so the existence of this music and the feelings that arose in me listening to this music, that was completely new. In the house I grew up in, we didn't have music. There wasn't there was a record player. They had some Russian war relief records from the 1940s. Somebody bought me an Elvis Presley record when I was it's like maybe they had five records, right?
And you totally missed
The
the
Beatles came late for me, yes.
Beatles. Right. Well, talk about, I mean, another one of the angels, which I feel is very important to your development, is Doris Lessing. And talk about her Golden Notebook and how that book changed your life.
Yeah, that book was really, really important to me. And at the point when that book came out, it wasn't long after Nina Simone's first album, it really made a gigantic splash because she wrote about the lives of women in a very honest, unvarnished way, and in a way that gave the same value to what people were feeling as to what they were thinking and doing. So the book, as you know, is divided into four color-coded notebooks and then a journal. And so stories are told from different perspectives within that. And for me, at that time in my life, I had gotten married to my high school sweetheart 3 weeks after I graduated from high school. A disastrous choice, but we went to rent a little apartment in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco while he finished college, and I did a job selling gloves and hosiery at a department store. And so these women in the Golden Notebook, they're artists, they're political activists. Lessing was very active in the Communist Party before the 20th Party Congress, told a lot about party meetings and how people infused their everyday life with their ideas or how they were in contradiction. Her character, Anna Wolf, in the book has an affair with a man who's blacklisted from Hollywood. So a lot of things that are happening in the real world were brought into it, but not in this sort of, red badge of courage. I'm starting at the beginning, telling one story and, adding details to it and coming out at the end. It said, well, what you and I were saying before, that multiple truths coexist and the facts don't tell the whole story. And what is the discernment that we need to understand the truth that will advance our lives, our missions in this world?
Well, let's talk about this, Reed, because you were talking earlier about self-education. Okay. Now I'm looking at how you get a book like The Golden Notebook. Okay. How do you learn or teach yourself to do critical reading? Okay. Because I remember when I went to Howard, I think my freshman, sophomore year, my professor, Dr. Gregory Rigsby, fantastic teacher, I think we spent a week on like maybe two pages of France Fanon. Okay. You know what I mean? And it wasn't even the rest of, I think it was Black Skin, White Mask. It wasn't even the rest of the earth. I'm like asking myself, if I'm self-educated and I pick up like Lessing, I pick up some very important text, am I reading it for enjoyment? Am I reading it? Do I really know what's happening in between the paragraphs? How do I teach myself to read critically?
It's a good question, but I have to say that the way a lot of critical literary theory and reading is conducted in academia today, you can't be confident students are coming out knowing how to read critically. They just know what the professor, in many
So
cases,
now you
thinks
sound
about
like you're writing
something.
an S article for the Atlantic magazine.
I'm for any magazine, I'm not choosy, but
Let
this
me
is
ask you a
one.
question this way. Let me ask you this way.
Yeah.
Do you feel at this particular point in life that you've become a better reader?
I think I became a writer because I was able to become a better reader, because I do believe that reading is actually the best training for writing.
Well, that's I taught for a number of years at the Bennington Writing Seminar, and that was the emphasis. But Liam Rector, who ran that program at that time, that he said, okay, we're not just producing poets and novelists, we're producing men and women of letters. And so you became a better writer because you were extremely well read. Now, getting back to your point, I recall there was a woman. She was middle-aged and she decided this was what she wanted to do, become a writer. She came to the writing seminar and she was so intimidated because she felt that everybody in her pod, a little group, was much more well-read. When, you know, when they say, "Oh, I read, so, you know, I read Joyce, I read Whitman," you know, and she felt like, you know, who are these people? You could see it was class, it was race, it was everything. And but she felt that there was not a place for her, and she got pushed out of the
Wow.
program. But it gets back to the whole thing about what you described, even in this last election, the educated versus the uneducated, people who have a high school degree and people who have a college degree. How do you bridge that?
Well, I think I'm lucky that I'm not easily intimidated, you know? I mean, there's a little bit of luck in if you're born smart, and I was. And so I had the
I like how you said that without apology. Ethelbert, I'm a genius. Let your listeners know that.
I'll give myself the genius if they give me the award, but in the meantime, I'm just saying I'm smart, and you know, I can add and subtract
And
both.
you know how many
Yeah,
fingers and toes you
there
have.
you go. And I, because I came from such a dysfunctional family, such a socially marginal dysfunctional family, it was very early in my life that I got the point that these people didn't know what they were doing and that I had better get on top of things and figure them out. So there was a personal stimulus to try to comprehend, to try to understand. And that's what led me, I think, through my reading as well, you know, to try to understand what's going on. Now, you know, I've had a little bit of exposure to, you know, structuralism, post-structuralist theory, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, at the time that that came onto my awareness screen, I thought this is being used, you know, Paul DeMond, right? This is being used a lot to cover up the misdeeds of people who don't want things to say what they plainly say, but want them to say something that gets them off the hook. So I don't think all analytical and theoretical approaches are equally useful. And sometimes I think they abstract people from knowledge in a way that's definitely not helpful. I, you know, how, if a, if I were teaching a workshop or a class, something that I often do, and somebody felt very intimidated by the other people showing off their knowledge, then for me, that would be a teachable moment where I would be able to talk to people about what's happening in this classroom right now. Because I've heard a lot of book titles thrown about, and I wonder what you think. Who has the most book titles here? What do you think that gets you to have the most book titles? You know, does that give you an advantage over the other participants?
You know, I'm glad you said that because I've been in these workshops, you know, sometimes somebody's read this. And I say, yeah, but I know Mickey Mantle's batting average back in 1962.
There you go. There you go.
and that accounts for some. But I want to move from the writing and have you talk about another angel and let our listeners know who this angel is, because when I looked at the book, there were names that immediately jumped out at me, but one didn't. And this one had a really important part of your life, and that's Alice Neal.
Oh yeah, Alice Neal. Love Alice Neal.
So talk about who
Well,
she was and
she was a painter. I can't remember when she died, but it was about, if I'm remembering correctly, it was about 20 years ago. She came up, she was one of these people who had a knack, a natural proclivity, a talent that was evident from the first. But she happened to be a working class woman from, I think, it's a town in Pennsylvania, if I'm remembering correctly, at a time when that really didn't give you a leg up. You know, she moved to New York and went to some Art Students League classes and stuff like that. But as she came into her maturity, she was a portrait painter. Thus, human subject was what interested her in that one way we're similar. I wish I could paint like her. And that's all she wanted to paint. And as she came up, the abstract expressionism and other forms of non-representational painting were on the rise. They were almost all men who were notable for practicing these particular painting forms. And what she was doing was just dismissed, you know. It was a big struggle. So she lived a hardscrabble life. She had a few different children. She had some tragedy. She lost a child. She moved to Cuba with a husband. She moved back. She ended up in a third floor walk up in Spanish Harlem, which is where she did all of her painting, and living on public assistance with raising two sons, but never giving up, you know, completely determined to share what she saw with the world. And in like the late 70s or so, when the guerrilla girls started to be visible, there was a rise of feminist theory in art. More women artists were becoming visible, even in, you know, the art world as bounded as it is. She was like rediscovered. And then she became a celebrity, which was kind of hilarious in a way, because she was a very grandmotherly person who, if you looked at her, she looked like somebody's, you know, like a maple syrup bottle grandmother kind of thing. And she played off of that a lot. You know, she had that kind of a shy and modest manner, but when she opened her mouth, something different came out. But she didn't particularly want to be made use of by ideologues of any stripe. And so she disrupted a lot of the, you know, occasions where she was asked to speak about her work. But her work is so, everybody should now go online and look her up. It's N-E-E-L. And there's a couple of films about her that you can watch on like YouTube and that kind of thing. She was incredibly good at capturing the essence of a person who was sitting for her. All her painting was from life. And as she became more visible in the art world, she painted Andy Warhol with all his scars for where he was cut up by Valerie Solanas, you know.
Well, let's talk about you, because when I picked up your book, the artwork, you know, I didn't realize it was your artwork. You know, I'm just reading the book, you know, and then I'd be like, oh, man, this is really, these drawings are really strong. You do portraiture. You're talking about Alice Neal. When you see a face, okay, what attracts you to a face? What you do? Are you like an eye person, nose, lips? What attracts you to a face? You say, okay, I can't bypass this face. I want to capture this face. Or do you want to interpret this face?
Well, you know, I'm a storyteller. So my painting is pretty narrative. You know, there's a story embedded in it somehow. Even the paintings I did past the angels are very much like that too. There's always some text on the front of it and so forth. So there's usually something I want to say. And the question is whether it's the person or what I want to say that comes to me first. But, you know, Ethelbert, it's not the attraction to a face. Sometimes people have sat for me and I didn't really like them that much, but they offered to do it. And I thought,
well,
great.
Well, let me interrupt you right there. One person I really like, and I like her face, is Miyuki, who just came back to join us.
Okay? She has a beautiful smile.
And what happened, you know, I could raise some money on stage by having you do her face and raffle it off. I'm kidding. Miyuki, why don't you talk about what we're doing in the fundraising drive?
I know. I appreciate you. I'm listening the whole time. I just took myself off camera. I didn't go anywhere. It's a lovely, inspiring, engaging conversation. I love the fact that you captured your angels. Ethelbert has a knack for capturing some of the most interesting and smartest guests that he interviews. Thank you so much for being here, Arlene Goldbard. We really appreciate it, and really appreciate you sharing all that you do. People, if you appreciate this conversation as much as I do, if you enjoy learning about the writing process or learning what inspired, Ethelbert is hands down one of the best interviewers, period, in any genre, in any space, or any type of media. He is able to get into the heart of a subject and really share with us things that inspire them and things that will connect us, things that make us all come together. And again, dealing with things of poetry and writing, making us smarter, making us more intuitive, making us more empathetic to each other and connecting us all. If you appreciate this, do as we got our first call earlier on. I want to thank James Weeks from Chevy Chase so much for making a generous pledge of support. And we also received a support on Cash App from Fandom. We have a ways to go. We can do that. But only thing, it just takes a few minutes. If you go to the phone, call us here at 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739, or go to wpfwfm.org and make a pledge as generously as you can. This is the end of your giving drive. This is your opportunity to make a contribution that you can get Take advantage of a tax deduction next April. This is one of your favorite shows here on the air at WPFW. Please show that support. Give the affirmation that Ethelbert deserves. Every time you make a pledge, you let him know how important he is to you and to these WPFW airways. Again, the number is 202-588-9739. You'll receive information. Ethelbert will make you have joy. He will make you smarter. He will engage you in ways that other people don't always do so. So please, if you feel about him as I do, please go to the phones. Help us make this goal to $75,000 between now and the end of the drive. We can do that with your help, one pledge at a time, one person at a time, and together we will build a better world. 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739. Cash App is $WPFW, or the new one is you can go to text WPFWFM 801-801. Thank you so much, and congratulations for another wonderful, wonderful show, Ethelbert.
Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Goldbarb.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we, the last few minutes that we have, Arlene, I want to ask you about something you said right before Miyuki was pitching. You talk about painting and drawing, and you talk about storytelling. And I want to come back to that storytelling and you writing your memoir, okay? Because this book is also a memoir. Sometimes we talk about the memoir and we talk about creative nonfiction. So I'm wondering, were the things where you just say, I'm going to make some of this stuff up, like I'm going to put a little more paint over here, or are the things that you decided I'm not going to leave, I'm not going to include in my memoir? Are there people, for example, you say, okay, this person was very important to me, but they were not an angel?
I had a criterion of hoping that at least somebody besides me would have heard of them before. So there are some people that I didn't pick who were important to me personally, but didn't have much public visibility. Like, you know, Alice Neal wasn't on your screen before, but if somebody was into painting, probably they would have, you know, they had a chance of hearing about her. It's interesting. I haven't met anyone yet who is familiar with all 11 angels. Who talked to me about the book. Almost everyone has said, I knew a lot of them. I shared a lot of them, but I never heard of Isaiah Berlin before, or, you know, John Trudell, who was he? And so the idea of sharing these people with the world was a motivator for me. And I wanted to make sure that I used that criterion of people that others could get access to. If you heard of John Trudell and you wanted to know more about him, you could Google him and get a ton of videos and songs and things like that.
I was going to ask you about with one of the angels, and that was Paul Goodman.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit about him?
I really love Paul Goodman, even though a lot of people found him personally challenging as a writer and a thinker. He really, really made an enormous difference in my life. You know, I met his work way back in the day when I became a draft counselor during the war in Vietnam at San Francisco State College, in a little hut that was set up for students who wanted to get deferments or become conscientious objectors or whatever to come and get counseling. And I was given his book, Drawing the Line, which was about, in part, included an essay about his own refusal of the draft to read, and that led me to all his other things. There's a few things I really, really loved about Paul Goodman, and one of them is that, you know, he said, people always accuse me of not respecting the scholarly or intellectual specialities enough, you know, because he was a polymath. He wrote a book about Gestalt therapy, he wrote a book about city planning, he did plays, he did poetry, you know, lots of different things. And he said, that's not true. I have the utmost respect. Maybe, maybe not. But he said, that's not true. I have the utmost respect for the knowledge specialties. But for me, there's only one subject, which is human beings in their, he said, man-made, but, you know, human-made world and the things that they think and feel and do.
Well,
and
you know, when
that's me too.
That's you. You know, one of the lines in your book that I felt would be in the beginning of a traditional memoir, it's the first line in your chapter dealing with Abraham Joshua Heschel. And you begin by saying, I was brought up with a strong Jewish identity, mostly secular. I think that one sentence is very interesting to analyze because it has a lot to do with Jewish identity, you know, as you say, strong Jewish identity, but then mostly, comma, mostly secular. Talk about how that different, because when we look at the Jewish community, it's not very monolithic. It's all these different segments of Judaism.
Yeah, and it's because, I mean, I will get an argument for this, but to me, this is both factual and truthful, Ethelbert, that Judaism is peoplehood, not a religion, in the sense that Christianity is a religion or that specific forms of Christianity are. But what happened is when so many Jews migrated to this country from Europe, where both Protestantism and various forms of Catholicism were the dominant, you know, faith-based groups, then the structures of that kind of religion where you have dogma and you, you're defined by your belief and so forth, kind of infuse some aspects of Judaism. But the reality of it is that it doesn't really have any dogma. You don't have to, you know, believe a certain set of things. Like there's no catechism, you know, there's nothing like that. And because of that, you can be very Jewish, which my family was. I mean, Yiddish was their first language. They came over from Russia right when my mother was born, and the kids grew up in these workman circle schools that practiced socialism and Yiddish culture. And I didn't, as another generation, I didn't get a lot of that. It was kind of a secret language from the kids, but the sense of belonging to a people. And of course, under the under current, you know, geopolitical circumstances, there are Jews who think the state of Israel should be abolished, and there are Jews who think that, that, you know, what Israel is doing is perfect, and every gradation along the way, there are Jews like myself who are horrified both by the Netanyahu government and Hamas.
How do you, as we get to the end of our show, how do you navigate being Jewish identity right now because of what's going on in the world? It seems as if there's a generation growing up who has a different sort of how they view their religion, their faith, as opposed to you coming up where I would say the Vietnam War and things that sort of really shaped you. And here you have another generation being shaped by what's going on in the Middle East.
Yeah, and I there are many reasons that my heart opens to young people these days. I mean, in contrast to just that 60s period of Vietnam and so forth, when we had a revolution of rising expectations, right? We felt like we were having a huge impact in terms of peace and civil rights and other things. It, you know, flash forward 50, 60 years, it turns out we had a big impact on social mores, same-sex marriage, legalizing dope, stuff like that, but very little on racial justice, on economic justice and so forth. But I think that the young people that I meet today don't have aren't in a position of seeing rising expectations. Very often what's driving them is the feeling of keeping the worst from happening, you know, which is a different situation, right? A different relationship to the world. So
I would ask you this question, Arlene Goldfarb. Do you have these angels and they are messengers? So I guess for a young person, the question would be, do I believe in God? And I say that because one person who's very prominent, writer, Ta-Nehisi Coates, throughout both his books says he doesn't believe in God. And I was just wondering, and this is why I like Ta-Nehisi work, because he doesn't come out of being this prophetic thinker like James Baldwin, but he's like saying, okay, you know, I'm here. I can't tell you what to do or you know, explain this, but I'm a journalist. I will tell you this is what happened. I walked the land. I went to Gaza, but I can't tell you what the future of the Middle East is going to be. But I'm wondering how, if you don't believe in God, how do you deal with your faith and how do you deal with the unknown? How do you deal with the future?
Well, talking about truth and facts, God comes into it pretty quickly. The late Michael Lerner, who was a very progressive peacemaking rabbi, he used to say, the God you don't believe in doesn't exist. What he meant by that was that there are a lot of people, especially professional atheists, who define God in a certain way, you know, a guy with a big beard who's sitting in a giant chair telling who's naughty and nice, and reject that, and therefore say God doesn't exist. What I always say about atheists is that I slightly envy their certainty because they seem to know everything in the world except how to explain the giant mystery that we're all living within.
Well, I'm gonna bring Miyuki back in so that maybe God will bless us and give her some more money here at WPFW.
We're waiting for God to bless us. Absolutely. Thank you so much. We've been blessed by Ture Ann, who made a very generous pledge of support. Thank you so much for your web pledge. And it says, in the beginning was the word. Ethelbert keeps light and awareness to the most precious gift of life, the written word. Thank you so much, Ture Ann. And Grace from Annapolis, Maryland said, good show today, Ethelbert, from Grace. And I don't know if that's our Grace or not.
That's amazing, Grace. That's great. That's Grace Cavalieri.
I think so too. Hey, Grace. Laura Tucker sent you a pledge as well. So we're chipping away. We only need $275 to go. 202-588-9739. If someone could become a sustainer and maybe make a pledge, a generous pledge of support, or someone could just send us a couple hundred dollars and we'll be there. Again, the wonderful Ethelbert doesn't get a penny of this because he is a volunteer. He volunteers his mind, his talent, his passion for words, for WPFW, so that we can continue to grow here at the station. We have 5 minutes remaining. A couple of, he's laughing when I say that.
I'm saying, at the end of the year, I should send you a bill.
No, please don't send me a bill, Ethelbert. Please don't. You are a wonderful, wonderful volunteer. And we're loving Arlene Goldberg, who loves Nina Simone. It's so interesting because as a station that plays a lot of Nina Simone, just to hear how Nina Simone affected, changed, and filled her life and connected her to us in a different way as well. Again, we're about community. WPFW is here for you. Our mission is to make the world better. You can help and make it better too by being smarter, by investing in something that will ensure the future of our the next generation. Please, if you're out there and you listen, you have yet to make a pledge, we only need $275. We can do that very easily. One person can knock that out. Just get us there, and I'll just be quiet. I'm trusting you're going to 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739, or use the Cash App, $WPFWFM, or text to WPFWFM to 801-801. Thank you so much for such another wonderful, wonderful conversation, and looking forward to seeing and hearing more angels. Looking for the WPFW angels, 202-588-9739.
All right. Well, Miyuki, I'm going to sign off. Arlene, I want to thank you very much for being my guest. And is it all okay to sign off, Miyuki? Okay, I'm going to sign off. I want to mention, your book once again, which I think is beautiful. And that is In the Camp of Angels of Freedom. And so Arlene Goldbard was my guest today. She served as president of the board of the director of the Shalom Center. She's not just a wonderful writer, she's a fantastic visual artist, and she's a social activist. And we know we need social activists today. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM. My name is Ethelbert Miller. Oh, you want to say one last thing, Arlene?
I want to say thank you, Ethelbert, for having me. It's so fun to talk to you, and I really appreciate it. And to let the listeners know, if they go to NYU Press, they can get a discount of 30% if they sign up on the mailing list for the book.
Okay. Well, thank you for that note. Okay. That's a wrap. That's it. Okay. And the station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. It is such an exciting day. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge. Maybe